So now we have artist Tim Sullivan as stand-in for Stephen Wolfe.
Oh no, is this working? All right. So I'm not Stephen Wolfe, but if I were Stephen Wolfe, my eyes might kind of burn and be tired right now from trying to and trying not to stare at Brenda's fishnet tights over there. I had to get him back for something. All right, here's his story. And sorry, Brenda. The true dealer helps the world by revealing mystical truths. When I was 13, my mother dressed me for my friend's bar mitzvah like a small-time pimp. She's Italian. She didn't know any better. So her announcement that she would no longer buy my clothes now that I was in college came as welcome news. Faced with the cost of my own threads, I began patronizing thrift stores, and there were tons of them in New York's East Village where I lived. They each had exactly what I wanted, old button-down shirts, cardigan sweaters, and dark overcoats. This was the costume I could better inhabit the character that I had created for myself, a moody, sullen 19th century European philosopher. Walking cold streets in fading winter light, lost in a dream of Kantian puzzles and Kierkegaardian paradoxes that defined my college years, I was oblivious to the contemporary art explosion going on around me. It was 1981. I lived in a ground floor apartment on 10th Street between St. Mark's Place and Avenue A, pretty much ground zero for that scene. And yet I barely noticed the mushrooming galleries like Civilian Warfare, Gracie Mansion, and Nature Mort, and the artists they showed, Keith Haring, Kenny Scharf, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Jeff Koons. When I moved to Los Angeles in the late 80s, my awareness for the art being made and shown around me was only marginally higher. Forced to flee the comforts of my 19th century Konigsberg by my need for a paycheck, I parlayed my knack for letters into a newspaper job, whose beat covered politics, business, and crime. I showed up at my desk, made my deadlines, broke some stories. Occasionally, an art world controversy spilled over into my bailiwick, like the time Jenny Holzer arrived in Little Tokyo to soothe hurt feelings among the residents she offended there with her new mural. Painted in the colors of old glory, it featured a series of questions like, who salutes longest, who prays loudest, and who dies first? The old-timers who had been confined in internment camps during World War II were not happy. Contemporary art seemed to me then, as it does to many outsiders, an arbitrary world governed by incomprehensible rules, policed by an alien force of artists, curators, collectors, and other eccentrics. There didn't seem to be anything in it for a person like me who loathed decor and for whom the new in art was akin to the new in fashion, a fake construct perpetuated to keep people buying. I have to say, it's funny that he says, at this point in his life, he loathes decor. A couple weeks ago, he was so excited to bring me up to his office where he had just bought this terrible table, Greco-Roman table that looks like it was maybe a prop at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And as I stood in front of it, just kind of bewildered, just unsure of why he was so excited about it, he was like, don't you wonder how many people had sex on that thing? And then I said, what are you going to do with it? And he's like, I think I'm going to have it as my dining room table. Anyway, the disconnect between me and contemporary art wasn't entirely my fault. Several times I tried to make contact. Once when I got to interview Frank Stella about one of those garish, trippy wall constructions he began making in the 1980s, I studied his work for hours, but he doused my questions with condescending banalities and claimed he could not even remember whether the work was titled Dusk or Dawn. Different chapters in Moby Dick. It's one or the other, he said in that famously nasal voice. I should do an impression. It's one or the other. I don't know. kind of good Frank Stella. Someone do a better one. Everything changed in 1994 when I moved to San Francisco. I was living in the Mission and writing theater reviews for Backstage magazine, a euphemism for being unemployed. I was wandering around in a bubble that was part curiosity, part trance, with no schedule, no responsibility, no interest, and no obsession. I was open to a new idea, and it came in a copy of Caroline Jones's Bay Area Figurative Art. This was the first time I encountered art you could call regional. I was intrigued by the way this little group of artists rebelled against the prevailing aesthetic dictated by New York. Their struggle was so down to earth. It seemed so accessible. Everything about it was so local. It was the first academic art book I'd read for pleasure. Then, a week or two later, a reporter without a job, an investigator without a purpose, a penniless pedestrian in need of some new clothes, I walked into the Salvation Army store on Valencia Street. There it was, sitting on the floor, a drawing of a woman whose head seemed to be exploding in space behind her. I looked on the back, and the label from the Paul Cantor Gallery, Beverly Hills, confirmed what I already knew. This collage drawing was made by Nathan Oliveira in 1959. What had been a picture in a history book was now a prop in my own story. What appeared to be a study for a painting in this museum was suddenly hanging on a wall in my apartment. Categories that were previously neat and boundaried were suddenly breaking down. Like some self-referential Charlie Kaufman script, characters in one story were slipping into another. I wish I could say that I recognized the textual implications of all this right away, and that, like Hamlet, I uttered, "The time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right." But my lone thought upon taking possession of the elevator was, ka-ching, I quickly went to investigate its value. I got my first glimpse of the raw, self-serving mendacity of the art market. I did not recoil in disgust. I sold the work, and when I told people my tale, they acted like I'd won the lottery. One New Age character said, "I'd been led there by spirits." A month later, I was in Los Angeles. At the urging of a family member, concerned about my lack of direction, I submitted to a reading from a famed psychic. It lasted 30 minutes. But I can only remember one exchange. The psychic asked, "Does the word Valencia mean anything to you?" I lied and said no. He said, "They're telling me it's very important that something big is connected to Valencia." "Who are they?" I asked. "The voices," he said. I left a bit shaken. 1 week later, there I was again on Valencia Street, pounding the pavement, a reporter without a story, a man with a prophecy, idly poking around in, what else, a junk store. My nose in a pile of dusty books, I heard the voice of the owner, but distinctly disembodied, as though it were coming from another place. "I don't think I have what you want here," he said, "but they might have it up the block at Hocus Pocus." I'm not making that up. That was the name of yet another junk store on Valencia Street. I took my cue, and there I found three door-sized mahogany panels carved, I learned later, in 1927 by the Los Angeles modernist Peter Krasnow for the Temple Emmanuel. This most important commission, or his most important commission. One needle in a haystack had quickly become two needles in a haystack, and this one predicted by magic. Faced with the evidence, I could only come to one conclusion. I was a wizard. That I possessed magical powers. That I had become a divining rod for some universal force of aesthetic valuation. That I was what British antiquarians called a divvy. Someone who could sense authenticity and value with an occult-like skill. Had I been familiar with the work of Bruce Nauman, I might have proclaimed for myself, "The true dealer helps the world by revealing mystical truths." I can still proclaim that, but it means something very different now, because it soon became distressingly clear that I possessed no supernatural gift, was not channeling mystical information from a higher plane, but had merely stumbled upon the Bay Area version of Santa's Island of Misfit Toys. These amazing works of art were everywhere, hidden in plain sight. Thrift stores, garage sales, flea markets. There being few commercial galleries in San Francisco until the 80s boom, work by almost every artist who worked here has fallen through the cracks at some point. Some of the artists, like Oliveira, were well known. Others, like Sargent Johnson, a mixed-race artist from San Francisco who died obscure and penniless in the Tenderloin, were soon to get rediscovered. Still others, like Alexander Anderson, a Filipino realist who lived in North Beach and made pre-Raphaelite copies of old master paintings in the 60s and 70s, will probably never get their due. Discovering this local world of miscatalogued objects and the history of their authors was the first stage of my development as a dealer. Learning the standard, codified history of post-war and contemporary art came after. Strangely enough, so there was a time when I knew more about Bay Area painter Robert McChesney's early abstractions than I did about Andy Warhol's Marilyn. But it was the third part, what William Burroughs would call the job, that ultimately came to define my practice. What would be the construction of alternative realities, alternative histories, alternative assessments of value from works acquired through alternative means? An on-the-fly, dumpster-level, institutional critique. This perfectly suited my contrarian nature. However, I also saw myself reflected in a dark mirror that made me deeply uncomfortable. In that same year of 1994, after four decades of Democratic control, the House of Representatives was retaken by conservative Republicans. Led by Newt Gingrich, a group of little-known conservative outsiders signed the Contract with America and attempted to shake up the institutional complacency of the federal government. While I mocked their conservative social agenda, I couldn't help but see them as an unlikely analogy for my own story as an unschooled outsider whose insurgent curatorial process arose from a distinct lack of money, access, and knowledge. That's Stephen's story. I had never heard it before. After reading it, the first question I thought to ask him was, if when he was in college and looking for new clothes, old button-down shirts and dark overcoats were what he was looking for to complete his costume where he can inhabit a character that he created of a moody, sullen 19th century European philosopher. I'm wondering what the character is now that he's going for when he wears that 1980s kind of dead skin looking woman's leather jacket. Debbie Harry or something? I don't know.
Oh, that's great, Tim.
Thanks.